When are you going to leave for New Zealand and start the whole Hobbit?
Well, we do the first year of pre-production will happen in L.A.
Okay.
I'm going to have my usual group of designers. Before The Hobbit came to, I was essentially setting up for a very different life. I was setting up a house to lodge my DVD, monster, comic book collection, and my library. And that I think you know. Have you ever been to the library?
I've never been up there.
It's really quite an insane proposition. And, you know, it grew to such a degree that my wife and I had a very serious talk, and she said, get your own place and leave this house for the family. And mm-hmm. we did. I bought a little house five blocks away, and I was planning to create my office for pre-production and post-production.
Five blocks away. So your area of not Thousand Oaks, but
no, it's around between Agoura and Thousand Oaks. It's somewhere in there.
There are actual blocks.
They're what we call blocks in mm-hmm. suburbia. Is really they never go around the whole way.
All right.
But I bought a house and I called it Bleak House, and I got a secret bookshelf installed. I did one entire room in honor of the Haunted Mansion at Disney. I have the gargoyles, the portraits, the wallpaper, everything. And I was preparing to essentially live the rest of my life there. And then The Hobbit came, and I had so many things to put to bed properly before leaving for New Zealand that I requested that we did the first year of pre-production here, with me traveling to New Zealand every 2 or 3 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I've done that type of commute so often in the last couple of years, you know. London, L.A. became my Burbank, L.A. Kind of commute. Every 2 weeks, I would come from London to L.A., and it really, jet lag has no more effect on me.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a creature of imagination right
mm-hmm.
now. I really am like a gargoyle.
Speaking of which, do you have your book with you? Do you have any new drawings?
No, I got the new book. Mm-hmm. I got the new book. I am on page 2 of the new book.
Mm-hmm.
And I found it kind of puny to bring a book with 2 pages with me on a Sunday. But
How many books altogether do you think you've gone through
Two books that are very big and 2 books that are very small, so it's 4 books. And between the 4 of them, they are over 350 pages, and I'm starting the new one, and I'm excited about it. You know, every time I start a new book, I feel great,
because mm.
at the end of the day, if I can, I would love to leave those books for my daughters
mm.
to keep, like a reminder of. I would love to know how my dad thought, you know, what his thought process was.
Mm-hmm.
He's still alive, but I can't have that conversation with him. You know, when he was kidnapped, he came back, and I said, now I'm going to make it count. Now I'm going to have the conversations with him. I'm
mm-hmm.
going to ask him exactly more where he grew up, what his childhood was like, what are his dreams, his ambitions. And you have these lofty goals, and then he came back, and those conversations never really can take place.
You made an analogy last night that
mm-hmm.
stayed with me,
mm-hmm.
that he reminded you of a character in a film, someone. What did you say? I've forgotten.
I can't remember. Well, when he came back from the kidnapping, he was like regarding Henry.
That's it.
Yeah, he came a changed man.
Right.
He was really like a much more spiritual, generous version of himself. And,
right.
But I think that, my dad is such a, I love him so much, but he is a mystery. You know, he is such a mystery to me. And I really would love for my daughters to at least, I know I'm trying to be open with them and so forth, but the books are for me a little something that is very intimate, that I say, take a look at, this is your dad's brain
mm-hmm.
in many ways. Same with the library. You know, when I die, whether they like it or not, they read the books or not, for it to be preserved and they can use it, loan it, sell it, whatever they want.
Mm.
You know, the collection of books my oldest daughter, she's going to have an office in that house. She's going to come to work with me in the summer during the pre-production of The Hobbit. And she loves drawing with me. We draw together. She's 12. But we get along so good. You know, she's a little gorgeous mind that I admire. She's very much, she and my wife are very much Ophelia in Pan's Labyrinth, you know?
Is she as developed and as confident and interested in everything as much as you were at age 12?
I don't know about that, because I was totally into monsters at a very, very early age. The first things I drew were Universal Monsters with crayons, you know. So she's not into monsters that much. She's into other kinds of creatures, like video games. We love video games. Mm-hmm. We play together, but I don't play the tough ones with her. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't play the shoot 'em up, or I don't play the monster ones. But we play Sonic and Mario and Kirby. I mean, we have fun.
You don't personally play Grand Theft Auto?
You know, no, I do, but I do it because I'm fascinated by what can be called the sandbox of it. Mm-hmm. The motor, the engine of it is really fantastic. I think that tool I'm highly interested in developing into a storytelling tool. Because look, let me put it this way. Bresson would have killed to have that engine to tell a story of everyday life, as opposed to a story about an Eastern European thug raping, murdering, or stealing motorcycles. But the engine is fantastic. Mm. There was, in the early days of CD-ROM games, there was a Japanese CD-ROM called Gadget that I believe... Let me close the door, because I think it's...
Gadget.
There was a guy that developed a game called Gadget that I believe influenced film. It influenced me, for sure. Mm-hmm. I believe it influenced the Dark City, and I believe it influenced, in turn, the Matrix. You can still find images of that game on the net, if you Google them. And his sense of design is one of those things that just explodes on your brain. And video games, as an art form, are evolving so rapidly. And I find it appalling that none of us, and I include myself, are embracing them for the storytelling possibilities. You know, I would love to see, the way we see independent films, I would love to see independent video games that actually do like a Richard Linklater
video. Where did you create the Hellboy video game?
We did it with a company called Konami, and we developed it with them, but... it was developed with an existing engine, you know, or a modification on an existing engine. But I have a theory, and I tried to develop a video game called Sundown, and I found that some of the video game companies, at least the ones I encounter, they seem to be as conservative as studios are famous for being, if not even more. Perhaps because I'm the video game world, I'm not established. I was getting the reaction I would get from the studio in 1993. Mm. I was getting in 2003, you know? Mm. So, go figure. But I am very interested in developing storytelling tools there. I think the art direction of video games is supreme, superb. Mm. I think the sound design in those worlds is superb. I think that there's a real sense of immersive storytelling. But with two exceptions, I have not found, you know, you have great things emerge, but some of the most beautiful things is, there's a game called Ico that is fantastic.
How do you spell that?
I-K-O, I think, okay. Yes. And a game called Shadow of the Colossus, which is just a gorgeous piece of storytelling. Absolutely immersive, beautiful, and poetic. Mm. And you know, I would love... and they are, those experiences are akin to movies.
Right.
Bioshock, Halo, Resident Evil, Silent Hill. Mm. Many of them have great moments, great ideas, but But Shadow of the Colossus actually has, I think, the most engaging storyline and the most engaging intelligent gameplay in many, many years. Mm-hmm. Bungie is a developer that did some really interesting stuff in the early days of Apple, and I'm interested in them too.
It's when you say conservative tendencies amongst video game producers, financiers, you mean that they want whammy charts, they want violent hits, they want the usual elements, right?
No. What they do is essentially, you know, when you talk to a studio, the studio wants to know essentially the selling points, and it's the same thing on the video games. What is the box art? Mm-hmm. You know, in the same way that a studio would ask, what is the poster? What is the trailer? What's the catchphrase? What's the slogan? You know, the video game companies want to know who's the market, what's the box art, this and that. And not that the video game we were proposing was in any way an Antonioni video game. We were proposing a pretty slam-bang thing.
Yeah.
But I was proposing what I called a mandala of storytelling, which would allow you to essentially generate a video game that could be played again and again and again and transformed.
So there's no beating it, you mean?
There was not so much beating it as instead of orchestrating it around what you may call bosses, you know, finding a boss and killing it, mm-hmm. you would orchestrate it in a way that the drama would come to a high point, mm-hmm. and you would have to solve a dramatic issue, an mm-hmm. action scene, or. And if you didn't, you would die. But also, the permutations of that scene would be self-perpetrating. They would be triangulated, so they would bounce off of each other. It was an interesting idea, and I think it's doable. But the exact design of it, I will keep in case in the future I get to do it. But I'm sure somebody else will, soon enough.
So you're saying that there, in the landscape now, there are no people that have independent film attitudes about video games?
I think that there are amazing game developers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it can be Metal Gear Solid, or it can be Ico, or it can be Shadow of the Colossus.
Mm-hmm.
But in Japan, I believe there are people that are developing the video game as a narrative art form. But I would be very curious to actually see a filmmaker get involved with those tools and tell a story. As I say, Dazed and Confused. I'm not talking about a slam-bang action filmmaker. I'm talking about a slice-of-life type of filmmaker, you know? There was, as I said, there was a developer, Bungie. They had a very early game that I loved called Marathon. And I used to love being lost in Marathon. And there was that game Myst on the CD-ROM era, which, you know, part of the attraction of the game was just wandering around and looking around corners. You know, in the same way, people ask me, I love the Haunted Mansion at Disneyland. This is my, I could live there. And I'm trying to live there. And my favorite part of the Haunted Mansion is if you are the last guy in the group, there is about a space of 2 to 3 minutes between elevators of guests. If you stay in the gallery between the elevator and the boarding area, and you stay there for 3 minutes alone with the music and the portraits and the lighting and the windows, it's such a great, beautiful experience. It's spooky, it's great, and I think that in some video games, that experience, getting lost around a corner, is so great. You could do so. Silent Hill was all about the silences, the things between creatures. You were so unnerved by the sound design. So I think there's plenty to explore in those immersive private moments.
Just to get boilerplate on you, I started to ask you about the Hobbit thing. There's 1 year, you said, of pre-production
yes.
going to happen here.
Yes.
Then
I will be traveling, yeah. Uh-huh.
Every
2-3 weeks.
Two, 3 weeks, you're mm-hmm. going to fly down there. And then stay for 2-3 days and come back again?
Yes.
How come in this day and age you can't have in-depth creative meetings with you know, video screens and all that?
Because I'm a guy that loves to draw when I'm talking. So I'm talking and I'm doodling and I'm saying, do it like this. And if there's a clay sculpture, I get in and I re-sculpt it right there. And I think that the rest is not real. You know, I think when we talk on video conferences, it's like talking on a speakerphone. We all become fake versions of ourselves. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I hear you.
You kind of become self-conscious. And it's not the same as a face-to-face meeting. I think that the camera is always a witness, isn't it? You know what I'm saying? Even if it's a teleconference.
See, if my reaction when I first, when I began to understand that you were going to do this was that I had the idea that whatever very rich inventions you always bring to all your films, and the unusual, the moments of quiet and romance. And, you know, I had this idea or belief, I think others probably did too, that you're going to have to fit this into an overall Peter Jackson idea.
No way. You know, what has emerged from the very early talks on is that the idea, I know I'm conscious that in the second film, in the second half of the second film, I will have to blend in that second film. But the first film, I believe we're going to do some extraordinary stuff. You know, I love very much the idea of expanding. You know, what I think is, it's like you have a great building that somebody else bought and somebody else built, and they tell you, do you want to build the swankiest penthouse? You can. And I say, yeah, I will. I do a Frank Lloyd Wright penthouse to that building. And I think it's the ideas I have. You know, I have never had a canvas where, you know, every time my ambition exceeds the tools at hand. If we do Hellboy for 85, it is my appetite to do a movie that is $200 million worth. And it takes, and whatever they give me for The Hobbit, I'll try to make it look five times bigger. But the tools, what I can play with those tools, the monsters I can create, the worlds I can create, and the painterly idea I have for the palette and the color and the texture and the light, I'm very excited, man. I mean, I am like, it's the only book I read of Tolkien that connected with me at 11. You know, I read it at the right age.
Because I read that you didn't really have much success getting through the Lord of the Rings.
No, not at age 11. I bought, you know, back when I was 11, buying a book was a big deal because I used my allowance and my summer money to buy the books. And a friend of mine recommended The Hobbit and the Trilogy. And I bought the four of them, sight unseen, unread. I read The Hobbit first and I loved it. And I went into the Trilogy. And at age 11, it exceeded my desire for, you know, scholar knowledge and the complexity of the names and the places, and it did not engage with me. Now, as I have grown older, I have become a fan of all mythology, folk tales, fairy tales, the Eddas, the Celtic sagas, the Anglo-Saxon mythology, and so forth, and I now enjoy those rings, but still, to this day, the piece that connects with me is The Hobbit, because it's essential. Essentially, it is. It has a lot, strangely, a lot to do with the what Hitchcock used to do, which is, he would take characters that led very ordinary, passive lives, and threw them in extraordinary situations where their ethical sense and their moral sense got tested. And I think it's a very English thing, but I connect with it because perhaps it's also a very Catholic thing. I'm not sure about that. And you know, back in the day, there were two books that I was crazy about because they had fights with giant spiders. One was The Hobbit, and the other one was Richard Matheson's The Incredible Shrinking Man. You know, I always loved those images. You know, those are things that are kind of embedded into the soft tissue of the young mind, and they stay there, you know.
What did you hear? What have you heard about this Brett Ratner, Eddie Murphy version
of
Shrinking Man?
I have no idea. I really think.
I'd love it if you.
Oh, imagine that! But you know, I'm very glad. Yesterday, when I was in Laser Blazer, I bought the sci-fi movie box that includes that movie. I'm so happy because for years all I had was the Encore edition, the laser disc.
Yeah.
Of The Incredible Shrinking Man. What a movie.
Mm.
It's a great movie. It's very different from the novel in many ways, because the novel is more like an Albert Camus existential piece, and the movie has a little bit more of a spiritual, religious sense to
it. The ending in particular.
The ending, in particular, because it gets the God perspective.
Yeah.
Whereas in the novel, it ends in a very similar tone than the Camus novel, the opening himself to the indifference, the magnificent indifference of the universe, you know, which is fantastic. And I remember when I read Matheson, I remember where I read him. I read that novel in Lake Chapala, by the beach of the lake, and I finished. I read Bradbury that summer. I read Bradbury, I read Matheson. You know, I always remember where I read my first books and where I bought them. And some of them I still have. I still have The Hobbit, exactly the paperback I bought as a kid.
You are telling me that with all that you do and your very extremely active life, do you find time? How do you read books now? Where do you get
them? I do. I still do because, listen, the greatest thing on earth is those 10-hour commute flights.
Mm.
In those 10 hours, I'm learning mentalism, magic tricks. I'm self-schooled in those things. I'm terrible at them, but I have a very curious mind. I'm reading about medieval life. I'm reading about everything, and I only read the things I'm curious about. I try not to read by obligation. I don't go by the new books. I go to the bookstore or to my library and say, what do I want to read? When I read a biography, or I'm rereading Slaughterhouse-Five.
Mm.
I go by curiosity.
The some of the airlines, aren't they starting to offer online
movies
connectivity?
Yeah, they are. Certainly Lufthansa, and I think other British mm. airlines.
Mm.
But I try not to. I try not to. I watch a movie or two.
Mm.
You know what I do watch obsessively on the airlines is the cable series like Entourage or The Sopranos or Deadwood.
Yeah.
I bring the whole package and I watch the whole series. And I want the Wire, which I'm the biggest fan of.
Yeah.
The Wire, I think, has some of the best writing ever on any medium. You know, and rightfully on TV and cable,
mm-hmm.
the writer is the king, and it should stay that way. I think it's so fascinating.
What did you think of the final episode of The Sopranos?
You know, personally,
mm-hmm.
I loved it for the same reason that I loved the ending on No Country for Old Men, because I believe that in the audiovisual mediums, we are so prudish about experimenting like they do in the other arts. If a novelist decides he wants to start with a man contemplating a Madeleine and remember his life through that, he can do it. But in film, we don't take those risks. On TV, we don't take those risks. If a novelist like McCarthy or anyone decides to end abruptly or with a cat that leaves the house or a leaf that falls in the grass, they do it. And by the rhythm of the prose, by the sense of the storytelling, they can end there, rhythmically, poetically. And we don't do that in film. And I feel that experiments like The Sopranos, where they know exactly the conventions they are alluding to, they know the audience thinks they are two steps ahead. They say, okay, you're two steps ahead of me? Well, fuck you. Fill those two steps yourself. You know, you're that smart? Fuck you. Finish it yourself.
Yeah.
You know, why do you need me for? And I think that's such a smart thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same with No Country for Old Men. They, when people say, the ending's too abrupt, I say, where do you go from there? What do you want? What do you need as an audience? Do you need everything digested to be given to you? You know, and I say no, no. You know, more intelligent storytelling breeds more intelligent story readers.
So even the most rudimentary interpretations of the ending of No Country, I think that every person out there knew and accepted and respected that they were seeing an art film. They knew they were seeing something that was
absolutely, because it's deliberate. Yeah. I mean, the fact is, other arts understand very clearly since the last 20 years or more that it is the deliberate execution of a piece that gives the piece some meaning. And it can be the Duchamp autographing the urinal, or it can be the wheel of the pop arts like Andy Warhol painting the Campbell soup can. But in other forms of art, there is that the gaze is in itself the act of creating the piece of art. In film, when you see somebody as deliberate, as calculated and brilliant a filmmaker like the Coens, and they execute it, you know it's not an accident. You know they didn't fuck it up. They meant it to be that way. So, you know, I think it's exciting to see those frontiers being pushed. It's exciting to have the I drink your milkshake scene. You know, and if anyone fails along the road, God bless them. Because we need to. I say we need to fail more. We need to fail more trying ambitious, crazy things in these mediums. You know, it doesn't matter if you're doing a James Bond movie or you're doing an independent film. You know, I was in the Spirit Awards for 3 years. And selection committee. Mm-hmm. And I swear to you, there comes a point, if you watch long enough independent films, you see as much repetition as you see in mainstream films. Mm-hmm. Repetition of tick-like thematic stuff, rhythmical stuff. So, you know, I think that when somebody extraordinary emerges from the independent scene, or somebody extraordinary emerges from the mainstream entertainment, mm-hmm. I think they are both great expressions of the same form of art. I read Raymond Chandler with the same attention and desire I may read the Nabokov, right. You know, gladly.
You know, an idea just hit me. You're such a you're one of the most articulate and very easy talking film artists that I know, and I was just thinking that you know would be there could be a book in which you just talk to somebody mm-hmm. along the lines of Hitchcock Truffaut.
No,
you know,
when I get to the point where my work has done enough of the talking, it may be interesting to do that. I mean, I think that the beauty of that book, there are two books of film that I consider completely irresistible. There's that one, and a book by Tim Lucas on Mario Bava called All the Colors of the Dark,
okay,
which
that.
Is absolutely essential reading for anyone that loves film. And the fact is, Truffaut and Hitchcock found each other at the exact right moment. I think that in some ways that book kind of screwed Hitchcock's mind in a way, because Hitchcock was not fully comprehended before the Cahiers du Cinéma movement rediscovered him, quote-unquote. And I think that once he became conscious, less visceral about his choices, perhaps he stumbled a little bit more. But then, right towards the end, he vomited an absolute masterpiece like Frenzy, which came straight from the gut. It could have as well been an 18-year-old angry fucking guy vomiting that thing where the world is nasty, the people are nasty, justice is not there. It's such an ungodly universe. And the fact that a film with that camera shot where the camera pulls back from the murder scene,
yeah.
Which Quentin, I think, quoted in, Pulp Fiction or Reservoir Dogs, I don't remember.
Goes inside and the camera...
Camera pulls away. I think it was Reservoir Dogs. Mm-hmm. I'm not completely sure, but the fact that that guy at that age conceived that shot beyond the formalism, you're just attracted to the madness of saying, why don't we shoot it this way? I love it. I love it. You know, he is a god. So, you know, he hit. Truffaut was the right moment too. He was at the right moment. He was at the peak of being still part of the subversive artist He was still an incredibly articulate guy with a passion for movies. One of my favorite filmmakers.
Then he kind of got, I don't know if I'm that much of a fan of Family Plot, though. I tried to watch that.
No, I'm not a fan of that either, but the fact that, you know, very rarely you get a masterpiece like that late in your career as a filmmaker. First of all, rarely do anyone gets career that lengthy.
Yeah.
That is that lengthy. I mean, the amount of great filmmakers in Hollywood that do not work, you know, and I can think of people that have already gone, like Billy Wilder, or people that were never fulfilled, like Orson Welles, or people that are. I would love to see a movie by Irving Kirshner. You know, again, please give me one. And the list of people that you would find in the "oh, he's still alive" category is amazing. But in European cinema, you find these old masters in Eastern cinema. In Japan, a filmmaker can be active at 70. And it doesn't have to be Kurosawa only. I mean, these masters can have a lengthy career.
Mm. The Cha-Cha-Cha is doing what now?
We finished our first film, which is Rudo y Cursi, the Carlos Cuarón directed.
Right.
And we will probably open that movie in the winter, you know. We are preparing a second film. It will be either by Alejandro or Alfonso. I'm writing or starting to actually kind of toy around with my movie that is called Saturn and the End of Days. But is you know, these movies, I wish they came faster to me, but it takes years for them to percolate. I'm already, you know, thinking about, I'm moved by some scenes already, but I'm articulating it. Pan's Labyrinth took a couple of years. Devil's Backbone took about 8 years. Yeah, they percolate slowly, those ones.
I love the Devil's Backbone.
Yeah, me too. I think it's a movie that, frankly, I would love more people to, you know, if any good can come out of the whole Pan's Labyrinth experience, is I wish more people went out and got it. And saw it. I love that movie with all my heart, and it is. I always say it's my first movie, because it is. You know, obviously Kronos was a movie that I loved the idea, but it still is a first movie. There's a lot of stumbling, you know. Mimic, there's a lot of stumbling. We've talked about that.
Mm-hmm.
But then Devil's Backbone became almost miraculous for me. It became my first film.
It's funny that you say that Kronos has stumbling, because when I mean, that's the one thing that we have talked about that
mm-hmm.
people feel
mm-hmm.
it has that old man's quality,
yes.
Masterful, like a person who's taking his time.
Yeah.
Not, you know, but obviously you being...
No. I love the movie. I have a great affection for it, but I think I am in a time right now when I seriously don't let any color, any piece of texture, any piece of architecture be accidental in the movies. I try to really create the worlds that the camera shoots in detail. And when I see Kronos, obviously there's much more location, there's much more accidental use of some colors, and I would love to have controlled that. But you know, it's a first movie, and all that I am to this day, it's in that movie. You know, I am still there. You know, I recognize myself.
Is that wonderful older actor still with us?
Yes, he is. Federico Lupi, yeah.
Is he working and everything?
He's working in Spain. He lives in Spain now, and he works quite a bit.
Hmm.
Last time I worked with him was in Pan's Labyrinth,
yeah.
At the end of the scene. You know, he is God.
Mm-hmm.
Or at least
that's
the father.
Right,
the father.
The,
yeah, in the chamber.
Right, yeah. So, but what's Alejandro's next film? I mean, is he working on something himself?
You know, he's working on something. He has a sniper in a building across the street, making sure I don't say anything.
Is he like you? Does it take him a couple of years?
But you know, the beauty of it is, it's almost like we have formalized, you know, our relationship. So we've made honest men of the three of us, because now with the company, what we find is that we have the leeway, we have the right to call each other at midnight more than ever, and send each other a screenplay and say, by Monday I'm going to call you and tell me what you think. And we've been doing that. It's a lot of fun. You know, I've been reading what he writes. He's been reading what I write. We all talk to Alfonso and what's next for him. And they have plans.
What happened to his Mexico in the revolution thing?
No, the Mexico in the 68, in 1968? Well, I think he still would love to do it, but I don't think the circumstances are great for him to do it. He's only partial owner of that, and I'm not sure he's that attracted to doing another movie that he can't control completely.
Now, someone was telling me two things about The Hobbit. Someone was telling me there's going to be a year that you're going to have off between the shooting of both films?
No, there's going to be like a few months.
Okay.
No, you know, I'm going to... The idea is because I do consciously intend to, in the second movie, start veering towards an absolute act of mimicry. The sets and the ideas on the first movie are going to be different enough and wild enough that you have to slowly mutate them into what follows. But the idea for me is if this is a symphony, I would love to think I'm doing an overture. And you can see the reprieve of some themes and the coda of some things that, you know, or the prefiguring some stuff that will be echoed later, but that you have the freedom of have a really grand sweeping motion on the beginning.
You know, you used the term overture. I was just thinking how welcome I felt when the Lars von Trier film, Dancer in the Dark, used an overture.
Yes.
Which is, used to be common back then.
It's a David Lean I used to love the overture and then the intermezzo.
Yeah, the interact.
With the, that's one thing I'm looking forward for Blu-ray. I hope to God they transfer David Lean the right way.
Yeah.
You know, I would love nothing more than see those movies in the proper transfer. And by proper transfer, we talked about that. Proper transfer doesn't necessarily mean sharper, which I think is a big mistake, you know. But being on Laser Blazer yesterday and seeing the amount of stuff that is being put out. For example, the Kubrick transfers, I'm very eager to visit and check.
Is that entire set in Blu-ray?
There's only a few. There's only a few. What was great is I saw the most amazing set of the Kubrick films with exclusive covers in London.
Mm.
And I wanted to get all the covers and put the Blu-ray in. But, you know, there's a limit to consumerism. My wife said, you got them on DVD, you got them on Blu-ray, stop already.
Now, is your entire family going to live with you in New Zealand when you shoot, of course?
Yeah, yeah.
So they're going to go to school down there and they have to make new friends and the whole thing.
And we'll get an accent, I bet. although I didn't get mid-Atlantic by living in London.
Yeah.
I still have the same accent.
Yeah. A mid-Atlantic accent. When I think of mid-Atlantic, I think of kind of the way Kevin Costner spoke in Robin Hood, which wasn't quite a...
Perhaps so, yeah. It was more like Atlantic and back.
Yeah. Well, when you're going to be completely done with it? It'll be in 10 or 11 or what?
Yeah, no, the last movie, I think, the second movie comes out in 12, I believe, and, you know, if and when everything is said and done, the times I visited New Zealand, I have frankly loved it. I loved that place. They have two or three bookstores that are just mind-boggling in Wellington. The first time I went, I bought back a suitcase full of stuff. Oh, give us a few.
Are you okay?
Yeah,
okay.
Very fine. You know, I plan to explore that. The place seems so relaxed and, you know, the people are uncannily nice. So unless I discover a Lovecraftian plot where people like pray at a god that emerges from the sea every full moon or something, I think it's preternaturally beautiful, New Zealand.
How big is Wellington? What is it like, say, compared to Los Angeles?
Or it's much smaller. And you know, a traffic jam in Wellington, I think, is 5 cars.
Oh.
I think that's a traffic jam. As I said, the people are uncannily kind. They all remind me of Doug Jones. Doug Jones is very Wellingtonian.
Are there a lot of scooters like there are in Europe?
Not many. No. It's cars, but there's not that many. And it seems to be very art friendly. As I said, the bookstores that I found were great. And I always gauge that when I arrive to a country that I'm going to stay on. I quickly scan the bookstores and I say I can't survive. I unfortunately will come back with another library to add to the existing library, but I'm good with that.
Are you a naturalized U.S. citizen? Are you
no,
a citizen of Mexico?
I'm a citizen of Mexico. Yeah. Otherwise, I would be very interested this year. You know, but I'm interested in the sense that.
Vote in an election?
Yeah, because if America gets the flu, the whole world sneezes in a way. You know, politically, it's extremely important what happens now, and I really believe that we are at a crossroads of such importance. You know, it's not to be taken lightly in any way, but you know. You know, I'm not sure how fast and how deep anything that's not economic really hits people's consciousness. The immediacy of the wallet, I know, has caused social changes.
Sure.
I'm not sure if the ideas have that as profound an impact as that immediacy of the pocket.
I'm absolutely. Everybody I know is just absolutely. Is just melts in love with the idea of the metaphor of Obama being president because of that name and that heritage.
Mm-hmm.
He's so completely different than the ugly American.
Well, you know, I think that in Mexico, when the PRI stepped down from power and gave way to PAN. And the thing that people used to say, they said, well, we have tried the other thing. Let's try a change. Let's try something for a change. But I'm very prudish about talking about to-be politics in America. Once they are a reality, I feel more at ease. I think it's not my place that much to do futurology. In this type of thing, I do get a little prudish. Once it's a reality, I feel a more comfortable saying these things are happening.
Are you talking about a basic skepticism, a lack of trust in any politician anywhere?
No. My feeling is that it is always dangerously close to punditry when you engage in this conversation, and to be a pundit with an accent it feels just. Slightly odder, you know, like when I feel much more at ease talking about things that are already happening, you know, than to pretend I can project what is good for a country where I'm a guest. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
It's I know this country very well in the sense that we're neighbors and I've been visiting it since I was 4. L.A. concretely, I've been coming to L.A. to most every year of my life since I was 4. But the rest of the country, I cannot presume to have that much of an idea, or not enough of an idea to presume to dictate big declarations of what it should be.
I just love every time I speak to anyone who is in a Native American. I always find some insight comes from them, something unusual, something I had not heard from, you know, friends.
What I think is great. I do think these are not only great times, but it is without a doubt a time of choice, and it is without a doubt a time when. Everybody knows they can make history.
Mm-hmm.
whether you count or not in the final chronicle of that history, you are part of that moment. It is a historical moment, very much a turning of the tide, no matter what. We can go one way or another, but I tell you this, whichever way we go, it feels very much like one of the last legs of the world as we know it, if we take the wrong move. You know, because I think the changes that have occurred in the last few years have been so radical, mm-hmm. So complete in every aspect, I think the next the next 4 years and then the 4 years after that are crucial to what we make of for the rest of humanity, for the rest of what is left of history.
Have you ever had any periods of lethargy or depression or not enough activity in your life and just kind of lost? I mean, you seem to be so energetic and never flagging.
I think that I had it in the 20s at some point. The 20s are the hardest age. Yeah. In the 20s, everybody feels your life is wasted, kind of, because you're not quite an adult, even although legally you are. You can drink and acquire a weapon. But other than that, there are very few signs that tell you who you're going to become.
Are you talking about the early days when you first met Alfonso?
When we were all formative. We were all in the 20s, and you have no real... What is great about the 20s is the passion. Mm. I think that's what should not be lost. That's what should be kept alive, but... You have that lethargy of the impotence of, I cannot do the change I want to do. But no, I go back and forth. After the kidnapping, I had a forced period of lethargy where, at 33, after my dad came out, and I was...
97, right?
97, 98. I swear to God, I don't want to remember the exact date. And blame me for it, but I don't really even want to ask. I think it was 97, 98, I was 33, and I was essentially broke again, completely broke again.
You had to give up so much
everything.
Money.
Oh no, I started over, and my daughter got a kidney infection. I had to subscribe to a welfare. Slow payment program where I could pay $50 a month for 4 years or something for the 2 nights she was in the hospital. I did not, everybody said, oh, we love this or we love that, but it was right after Mimic, and in America the well was semi-poisoned, and in Europe, and then the miracle of miracles happened, Devil's Backbone came to be. And it's, by the way, the only movie where at no point I have deferred my salary.
Yeah.
Of every other movie I've made, including Hellboy 2, at some point or another, I defer my salary for the movie to be made. And then eventually, I get it or I don't get it in some cases. But like the first Hellboy, I never got the money back.
And for Pan's Labyrinth, you guys put some of your own money into the...
Yeah.
Was it the marketing or what?
No, we started putting from the more money from pre-production on. Mm-hmm. Eventually I got my directing money like a year and a half later. Mm-hmm. But even then, I mean, for Pan's Labyrinth, it was not that much to start with. It was not my quote or whatever, it was a movie done for low numbers from the start. But at that moment, after the kidnapping, it was a very desperate time, and when Pedro Almodovar came and said, we'll produce it, and I said, I'll do it for free, and he said, no, you're going to charge your salary. He saved my life. Huh. I mean, that movie saved my life. I was in lethargy in that moment because I could not find a way to pay the mortgage or the credit cards or anything. Mm. I was 33, two movies, and I couldn't find a space.
Well, I love, though, that you have, and it's in you to want to make the movie work anyway, even if you have to suffer financially.
There
are not enough people think like that.
One of the things the first times I came to Hollywood and I took a couple of meetings, One of the phrases I kept hearing is never put your money in, and I said, what the fuck does that mean? If you don't, then why should anyone? You know, if you're not willing to, I'm not saying you have to,
right.
But if you're not willing to, why is the movie worth making? Mm-hmm. You know, if you told me, look, that beautiful new house, bleak house with all your toys, and you're going to have to risk it to do Saturn and the End of Days, or you're going to risk it for this or that, I would do it again. You, even if they say to complete The Hobbit the way you want it, mm-hmm. I would do it.
Right.
I would say, take it. Take the toys, take the paintings, God damn it. You know, I think that there has to be that passion.
And yet, paradoxically, didn't you tell me that the
I hope I don't have to defer my salary.
But didn't I hear that you were very much on schedule with Hellboy 2? You didn't.
Yeah. No. We went about 5 days over schedule,
awesome.
Or 6 days over schedule.
Yeah.
But I think that you know when I work with a studio. The studios, fortunately, they know that I am fiscally very involved and fiscally very worried about the movie staying the course of the budget. You know, not straying from the budget, but I'm at the same time a guy that if I need an extra day, I'll just go for it, and I'll just say, look, give me the extra day. If you want to discount it later, discount it later. I don't care. Let's just go do it. And I was that way even on Mimic. On Mimic, there was one shot that, imagine that, 1997, Kronos never gave me any money. I never got salary on that when I put it all back. And there was a shot that was $120,000 back then. And I said, we need it. And they said, no, we don't. And I said, I'll pay for it. And if it stays in the movie, you'll pay me back. And in 1997, I bet $120,000 that I could very much use, and I got them back eventually.
Well, how do you mean if it stays in the movie? In other words, if they like it enough to keep
If we test the movie with an audience and the audience likes that shot and blah blah blah, you know, and even for that movie that you know I have so many, how would you say, contradictory feelings, contradictory.
Yeah,
feelings. Well,
anyway, well, I'd still like to see that book someday. So maybe 10 years or 15 years.
You mean how about Mimic?
No, the Hitchcock Truffaut.
Oh, the Hitchcock.
I would love. That would be a great book.
What I think is
on video too. You know,
on video,
with a compliment.
What I think is great. Look, you may agree with a filmmaker, or you may disagree with a filmmaker. But if the filmmaker is truly talking, I mean, there are some really interesting books. On the Faber series called, you know, Scorsese on Scorsese, Burton on Burton, which are essentially interviews, are a great way to get to know filmmakers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think if they are articulate about, forget about film, articulate about the passion they have for life, mm-hmm. food, books, whatever you want, it's great.
Mm-hmm.
I love hearing, for example, Orson Welles. When you get to see an Orson Welles interview, I don't care if it's in a DVD or in YouTube, the guy is such a great raconteur.
Yeah.
You know, and some filmmakers are such great, they enrapture you on their interviews or DVD commentaries. I loved listening to some of them. And some others, great filmmakers, are completely inarticulate.
Let me ask you, before we finish, what was your reaction to the John Anderson review in Variety, which came out last night, in which he said that that Hellboy 2 was it was funny, in a much successfully
yeah,
funny,
yeah, yeah.
in a way that the first Hellboy wasn't.
I have not read it, but I will read it. I would tend to agree. I think that the movie has a lighter, you know, in a superhero movie, every time they come with a second one, they all say it's going to be darker, it's going to be tougher. And I think it takes a lot of cojones to actually wear your heart on your sleeve and go out and say, the movie is at the same time melancholic and funny. And it can be that. You know, it can be that. It's not every superhero has to be addicted to heroin and going through the turmoil of a divorce or what, you know, some of the domesticity of the superheroes can have a little more zest, I think, because in my mind, the beauty of the character of Hellboy is if he is relatable. And I think Ron brings humanity with him, and we try to make him relatable and so forth. And, you know, we've talked about this in the past, and I think that especially in a time like this, very necessary to say that not necessarily a manifestation of lightness is a lack of purpose. It can be as purposeful and as valid as when you state the dark and state the cynicism. You know, it's just the problem that we have, I believe, as a culture is that we equate cynicism with intelligence. You infallibly will look more smart if you don't believe in something. When you believe in something, infallibly you'll look more like a dumbass. You know, when you declare I don't believe in love, people go, my God, he's an intellectual. But when you have the audacity of hope and you say I do believe in love, you are a sap. You know, so I think that I believe that the ambivalence that I always thought existed in Pan's Labyrinth, which is like a Rorschach test. When people see that movie and they come and see me, it's so bleak because at the end of the day, the magic's not real and she dies. I go, that's the lesson? That's the idea that came out of the movie for you? Which, that's not the idea that comes in the movie for me. Or you know, other people come and say, I love it that at the end the flower blooms and she did go to the kingdom and she... I believe that ambivalence was there. In Hellboy, there is ambivalence, and I think I think there is a very nice, strong stance about things not being perfect about the world and the imbalance between the human world and the spiritual or fantasy world is in and of itself. Interesting enough for me to have been involved in it, but still, it has to be a summer superhero movie with those ideas in there. And I hope people find it. I really hope people find a way to it. It's a very tough summer. It's probably one of the toughest summers in the way that every weekend
There's something else coming along.
Yeah, you know, look, you know, we were tracking steadily, and then Batman comes in, and all the tracking goes completely askew, and then you come back, you come to the point where movies like every week you're opening, that's when you have to watch, and I'm very eager. I really am. It's the only time. In my life, when I'm watching how a movie performs for one reason, because I really, sadly or not, I would love to do a third one. So you know, it's almost like watching Wall Street. You know, the hourly rate is, and I don't like the exercise, but I'm learning to put through it. You know, I'm learning to put with it. You know, it's unnerving.
What do you think will be significantly different in terms of visual values in your fantastical realm, say, what's going to be significantly different, say, 15, 20 years hence? What would you imagine would be something we don't see today, but will be almost taken for granted 20 years then? What do you think is the big thing that we're going to experience?
I think that the one thing that we're going to see, if I'm going to sound like what was the name of Johnny Carson?
Ed McMahon.
No, the
psychic. Oh, the great, yeah, right. Mm-hmm.
Chris, what was it?
Carsonian or something.
I don't remember. if I'm going to do that, I'll say this. I do believe we're heading towards an inevitable transformation in the way narrative is going to become a single platform narrative. I believe that video games, movies, TV, and all audiovisual entertainment is going to surge out of the same platform. And it's going to find a way to self-replicate in a way that you can follow an adventure slash TV movie, whatever you want, you know, a series, in a way that you can follow it for a year, 2 years, 3 years, if you want to. And it I think, will become, in some ways, interactive with the people that are watching. The watcher will be part of the storytelling. I would be very interested in this. And contrary to people that are afraid or hate video games or hate TV or comic books, I'm actually incredibly intrigued by all these forms, because I think that the moment you find a new form of storytelling offensive, I don't care if it's YouTube or a digital camera or an empty MP3 over a music, you're growing old. You're going out of whack with what's going on. And I think there's a beautiful anecdote that I would love to tell you that I find very significant that alerted me to growing old. And there's an animator called that signs his animations Blue, B-L-U, just Blue. And he does animation in the walls and the streets. You can find it on YouTube very easily. And I think he's masterful and brilliant and conceptually audacious. And so, you know, I did a crazy thing. He has his own website, and I wrote him, and I told him, I adore your work. Is there a way to help you reach a distribution or something that could allow you to compete for an Academy Award for animation? And I thought it was a sensible thing to, a smart thing to say. And, you know, a week or 10 days passed, and I get an email back from the guy. And the email is wonderful. It says, "What's Academy Award?" He just didn't know.
Yeah, yeah.
And he just did not care. And I think that the fact that YouTube, as co-opted as any of these things can be, the fact that we can be viral about the way we tell our stories is such a privilege. It's such a privilege that was not or is not accessible in any other media. And it's a cause for celebration, because now more than ever, that little prediction Francis Coppola made so many years ago, saying about the fat little girl, I think it can come true, and I hope I live long enough to see it.
I don't know.
Yeah.
I was told to get
you. All right.
Okay. Thank you for letting me go along.
No, man. Hope you see it soon.
Yep. I'll.
I'll get you the July 1st. Okay, great. That's gonna be a fan screening. Look. This is the screening.